The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
I'm really curious about why you didn't include Psycho Sheep of Butte.
I did not come across it. Psycho Sheep of Butte?
Yep. Killer sheep threatened to take over the planet, starting at Butte, Montana.
Well, you know, I told people one of the great things about writing a book like this is for months afterward, people will come up to me and say, why didn't you talk about this one? And I'll be like, yeah, add it to my list.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Aaron Parrott about his book, Literary Butte, A History in Novels and Film. In the introduction to Literary Butte, you wrote, quote, "The West referred as much to a way of doing business and developing enterprises as it did to a particularly bounded region of the country," end quote. How so?
Really, I'm talking about two things there. One is that it's really difficult to pinpoint the West as a geographical region. I think probably the best description of it that I've read has to do with the lack of water. That's what defines the West. So then you would exclude places like, you know, Oregon and Washington. And I think that's really true of any geographical region in the country. It's really hard to define the South also. You know, having lived there, I'd have similar conversations there. But I think one of the things that you can use to describe the West, at least in the cultural idea of it, is that it always was a place where it was just beyond the firm grasp of the law. That if you wanted to go to a place where you didn't have to worry about government oversight of whatever you were doing, the West was the ideal place. And not that it was really completely lawless, at least after the first few years, but it always, you know, Butte's a great example. It was easier to buy everybody off, I guess, is what I'm saying.
You also mentioned a term called Gilded Age.
Right. As far as I know, that's a Mark Twain term. That he coined to describe the economic disparity of the 1870s and after. So really, I think the Gilded Age is thought of as, you know, roughly 1870 to 1910. But what he was observing about it was that you had, on the one hand, ridiculously wealthy people at the top, you know, the gilded part. But I think in the phrase where he coined that term, he also talked about that covered up an interior that was rusting, and that referred to the vast underbelly of the rest of the population that was impoverished. And part of the reason that this would be another big theme about all these novels that's relevant today is the great disparity between the 1% and the rest of the country. In fact, I think the figures I've read, people are saying that we've never had such economic disparity as we do right now since the Gilded Age. So the Gilded Age is very much an age like our own.
This is a very colorful time, a very colorful town. There's lots of disparity. There's lots of environmental degradation. There's lots of criminal activity. What a great place to pull information and people, characters for novels.
That's true. At one point in there, I say, you know, the War of the Copper Kings. I'm really surprised nobody's made a, you know, blockbuster movie, because it's just ready-made for the stuff of high drama and a Hollywood treatment. You got, you know, pretty colorful characters doing battle on the hill. You got labor versus capital behind it all. And not to mention, you just have people who live in Butte who are pretty colorful characters, Callahan the Bum and Shoestring Annie and all these different people that, you know, their lives don't all overlap, but Butte's full of pretty famous characters that would lend themselves well to literary treatment.
Oh, contrary to popular belief, Mary MacLane was not the first novelist to come out of Butte.
And that was a big surprise for me. And I found this book sort of at random. I collect books about Montana and books in general. And I happened to open up this book and saw the word, I think it was Silver Line Club, which made me think the Silver Bow Club. And so I read this novel, and it turns out it's set in Butte, and it's about Butte during the Silver Age preceding the Copper. And it's fascinating. And she turned out to be a pretty amazing figure, married to Lyndon Bates, who was an engineer who helped design the Panama Canal. And, you know, these were Fifth Avenue New York people who lived for a while in Butte. Information about her is pretty scant. I'm still, you know, doing a lot of research on her, but pretty amazing that she wrote a novel about Butte in 1888. That might even be one of the earliest Montana novels.
And it's important, you noted, not only because it's the first one you found, but it's written by a woman. It's written by someone who didn't grow up there, so that perspective is always different than an insider's point of view. But it's also a novel that can document that historical moment before copper took over.
Right. It's right on the cusp of that. You know, they're starting to shift to the copper, but she's still describing people, for example, sinking shafts by hand and using hand-cranked windlasses and so forth to bring the ore out.
And bring silver ore out.
Right.
Because the way you describe it, they started with gold.
Yeah, Butte was originally a gold camp like Virginia City or Helena, although the gold wasn't as prosperous there as other places. So I've been told by people who know a lot more about it than I do that this is an oversimplification. But in general, in a vein structure like the Butte Hill, people start by placer mining for the gold, and then as they dig deeper, they get to the silver, and then beyond that, you get to the copper, and that's all a function of the mineralization from when it was all coming out of the earth.
So her novel documents this time before copper. big money
right.
moved in.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And back to Mary MacLean, I'd just like you to read a short passage from chapter 2.
Okay. Chances are good that a century from now, long after literary critics have stopped debating whether A.B. Guthrie or Norman MacLean wrote the great Montana novel, Mary MacLean will still draw readers to her clutch of odd books. The Story of Mary MacLean, 1902, My Friend Annabel Lee, 1903, and I, Mary MacLean, A Diary of Human Days, 1917. It strains the meaning of the term to call any of these works novels, but no other descriptor, memoir, prose poem, philosophical meditation, quite captures the brazen novelty of the work Mary MacLean delivered to the world in the first decades of the 20th century. Her idiom resembles philosophy much more than it does biography or fiction, which has led some to draw comparisons to Nietzsche, and both authors present their ideas in ways that defy convention or easy categorization. Like Nietzsche, Mary MacLean shocked her contemporaries by creating a style of writing that set more precedents than it followed. In 1882, Nietzsche scandalized Europe when his madman ran into the marketplace and announced the death of God and the gay science. But Mary MacLean did him one better when she tried to title her first book, written at the precocious age of 19, I Await the Devil's Coming. Naturally, her publishers squelched that idea. Very few among even the most free-thinking of readers in 1902 could have avoided blushing at the thought of displaying that book on their shelves. Herbert S. Stone and Company published the book, having caused a sensation a year prior by publishing Kate Chopin's The Awakening, another book by a precocious young woman who scandalized a society dominated by male taste. Instead, MacLean's book appeared in bookstores under the more humble and engaging title of The Story of Mary MacLean. It was a bombshell, selling over 100,000 copies within the first few months of its publication, according to the preface of Tender Darkness, a recent compilation of her works. America in 1902 remained prudish and pious, and her irreverence and unashamed commentary on her sexual feelings and intellectual inclinations shocked the country and intrigued the rest of the world. The New York World hired her to write a series of articles in the wake of her new notoriety, announcing that her book, quote, has been unquestionably the most widely discussed book of the year.
It sounds like the 20th century equivalent of 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, that might be a good comparison, although the more you read about Mary MacLean, you realize that probably the best comparison would be Lady Gaga. I mean, she was a great self-promoter, and definitely on the cusp of ordinary taste, conventional taste. And she really kind of cultivated the personality of herself, or maybe Madonna.
Mm. What happened to her after that book was published?
She followed up that book a year later with my friend Annabelle Lee, which in many ways is an even better book, although the critics didn't think so, and it doesn't get nearly the press that The Story of Mary McLean gets. Very quirky book, probably more like a novel. And then she didn't write another book for 15 years about when she published I, Mary McLean, in 1917. A few years after that, I think 1924, she died destitute and in very poor health in a hotel in Chicago. So it was not a good end. But to her credit, she anticipated it by saying, "I'm sure I will have an early grave," or something. I quote that in the book.
Do you think it's unusual for a third of the books that you found to be published by women, these literary novels, and for so many of the men to write strong female characters that came out of Montana?
I do think it's unusual. But on the other hand, it's an interesting problem. I'm pretty sure it's Elaine Showalter, a famous literary critic, who said, if I recall correctly, that in the 19th century, 75% of the novels written were written by women. But then she said, name a woman novelist from the 19th century. So while I think that women wrote a lot more than men probably did, their books, for whatever reason, probably mostly politics and chauvinism, vanished from the canon. But then when you think about Montana and Butte specifically, I think it is pretty surprising that, so many of these books were written by women. More surprising than that, as you mentioned, is the fact that the men who write about Butte, depict these women that are very independent, unconventional. And that is pretty surprising, especially the time period in which some of these were written, 1920s.
Mm-hmm. Although if you were in Butte in the 1920s, I think you would have to be very strong, man or woman.
Right, and to take a specific case, one of the great treasures I found in my research is a book called High, Low, and Wide Open by a guy called James Francis Rabbit, and that book is out of print, really hard to find. But his book features this woman who's, just like a 1970s feminist, but the book takes place in the 20s. And then you read about his own life, and his father died in the mines when he was 3. And so his mother raised the whole family, I think 4 siblings, meanwhile leading the crusade to get women the vote when he was a child. So, she's obviously a role model for him. That's my theory.
True, right. Joe Duffy wrote a book called Butte Was Like That, and aside from the book, you also noted him as the perpetrator of a hoax called Centerville Ghost. What was that all about?
I read the account of the Centerville Ghost, and it's in the book, the WPA book, Copper Camp, if anybody wants to read the whole account. I can't remember the details clearly, but he, for a long time, would tell people who came to town that there was a ghost in Centerville, and I think he and some other cronies actually faked it.
So they were out in the bushes at night?
I think so, yeah. I'd have to reread it. I don't remember exactly, but it's a pretty famous Butte story, and he took credit for it. He was a real local character. He was a laundryman, and that book, it's hard to read if you're expecting a conventional novel, but what's great about it is it's a sort of compendium of Butte culture. Like, he gets everything in there. He said he had access to stories that, ordinary people wouldn't get, that they wouldn't tell the newspaperman, but they might tell the laundryman.
In the same way that James Joyce once bragged about Dublin, which you note in the book, that Dublin could be rebuilt from his descriptions in Ulysses, you claim that Butte Was Like That could have been used as instructions to rebuild Butte back in the day.
Yeah, that was the, they're both Irish, and that struck me as a good point of comparison, that James Joyce used to brag that if Dublin had been destroyed in World War II, that they could have built the whole city back up from his descriptions in Ulysses. Obviously hyperbolic, but you get the point. And I feel the same way about Beat Was Like That. I mean, he covers everything in that book, the way people talk, the way they dressed, little vignettes about, you know, being a cab driver or a hack, vignettes about the Copper Kings. He just covers it all in a really neat way.
And what was the time frame of the novel?
I want to say it's the Copper King era, but he covers a lot of ground. So I would say roughly 1880s to up to 1920.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Aaron Parrott about Literary Butte, a history in novels and film. If you just tuned in, you can hear what you missed and find dozens of other The Right Question programs at our blog, which is located at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to this program on our Facebook page. We'll be right back to talk about what Aaron calls Butte's inherited anxiety and a steamy romance 2,000 feet underground. Don't go away. A bit of trivia from the section you wrote about the novel Coppertown, which was a Harlequin romance by Paul W. Fairman. You noted that it might contain the only sex scene to happen in a mine 2,000 feet underground.
That book, surprisingly, is a really great Butte book. And I couldn't establish this for sure, but I think Fairman must have visited Butte. I mean, he really gets the sense of it in a lot of ways. And what I liked about some of those pulp novels, there are two or three that I looked at, they tended to collapse all of that Copper King stuff into a few short paragraphs, and then they get right to the business of a narrative, you know, and telling a story. And that one is surprisingly salacious. There's a lot of violence, a lot of sex. But when I read that scene of the two main characters, you know, in the 2,000 or 3,000-foot level of a mine, I thought, this has to be the only time this happens in all of literature, at least in Butte.
Probably so. Doesn't seem like a very appealing place.
Although as a nice, I guess as far as the salaciousness goes, there's a 1980s novel, Dorothy Bryant's The Berkeley Pit, that has the protagonist now in the abandoned mine shafts growing marijuana. So I guess a lot has happened in those mine shafts.
Nice and warm down there.
Right. Little grow lights.
And speaking of warm, the devil appears as a person or symbol, I guess you would say, in a lot of the novels from the late 1800s and early 1900s.
Yeah, that's true. I think lots of comparisons to Dante's Inferno. And I think people have a hard time remembering this or visualizing it. But when the Copper Kings were in their heyday and they were smelting a lot of metal right in town, there was no greenery at all, not even a blade of grass, Mary McLean says. And this noxious pallor of sulfur smoke that just hung all the time over Butte. And sulfur's always been associated with the devil, too, so.
And some people tried to say that it was good for people's health, that air.
It's funny. Burton Braley is one of them. He, you know, people would laugh it off and say, you know, it's good. It prevents you from getting sick, at least, you know, getting the flu or whatever.
Because it kills all the germs and microbes in the air.
Right.
You mentioned what you called an inherited anxiety, a feeling of anxiousness that was pervasive in Butte, at least in the early days, and maybe has carried over into modern time.
I think it has, and it's hard to put your finger on it exactly what it is, but even today you go to Butte, and I guess I speak from personal experience. I grew up in Helena, but I was born in Butte, and all of my extended family still lives there. And there's just this sense of impending doom that I think is sort of a force of habit from all the years that people worked for the company, and at any moment there could be a strike, or at any moment the price of copper could fall and everybody'd be out of work, and then everything would collapse. And even when times were good and people were working, they worked for pretty miserable wages for the most part. And when you were working in the mine, there was always a chance, I don't know what the exact statistic is, but pretty good chance that you could die doing it. So you add all that together, and it's just created this sort of anxiety, for lack of a better word.
I think it's also created a live for today.
On the other hand, I think that's really good and really worth pointing out that existential is the word I use in the book a lot. People are surprisingly philosophical about, including the environmental degradation part of it.
Yeah, the fact that there's a toxic lake sitting up on the side of the hill.
It's even worse than that. Back behind the pit is the Yankee Doodle impoundment dam, which holds back, a comparable amount of toxic waste that if there were ever an earthquake, that would for sure spill down into Butte.
So let's have another shot. What trends have you noticed in the most recent decades of Butte's literature?
Also a good question. Another thing that surprised me was how many novels have been written just in the last decade about Butte. As far as trends, I'm not sure I could point to one, because the novels I read that were all written after 20, let's just say the year 2000, tended to be all over the map. Probably the most conventional one is Richard Wheeler's The Richest Hill on Earth, which is great, and that covers the Copper King era in a great way. But some of the others were really quirky, like Paul's Tutongi's Evel Knievel Days involves a kid whose great-grandfather is William A. Clark. And I think it's his mother who is a descendant of William A. Clark. That's right. And then his father is Egyptian. And so it involves him trying to track down his father in Egypt. Meanwhile, he's got this ghost of his great-grandfather, urging him on. I thought that was pretty bizarre, but also in a way very representative of Butte because it's so multicultural. And then you have Rife Larson's book, The Collected Works of T.S. Spivet, which is about a precocious little genius. I think he's 6 or 7 years old, who is a compulsive cartographer. He draws maps of everything, and he ends up getting an award, and so he travels from Butte back to Washington, D.C. There's really not a consistent theme you could point to, I don't think.
But it's gone beyond just being about the company town and the Copper Kings.
Oh, that's absolutely a great point, is that in a lot of these books, the whole copper mining thing is not even there. I mean, they mention it, it used to be a mining town, but they're looking at it as something completely different. And that's true of Sam Shepard's movie, Don't Come Knocking.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the films that I looked at too.
I just want to make one more point that you noted in the book, that in modern novels, Butte seems to be more of a setting because of the unusual features and the colorful history instead of being a Montana setting.
Yeah, that's true. And I think Butte is an unusual place in terms of Montana culture, because I don't think people, tourists from the rest of the country, come to Butte to hike in old growth forests or fish in blue ribbon trout streams. If anything, they pass through it on their way to somewhere else. But you can't help but notice, even from the highway, that it's some remnant of the old West. I think that's true.
And that it's very different from any of the other cities,
right,
towns they've passed through.
Somewhere in here, I say it has probably more in common with Pittsburgh or Chicago than it has with Missoula or Bozeman.
Mm-hmm. And it's just something that's completely unique.
Yeah, it is. And it was even when Joseph Kinsey Howard was writing about it in the 40s and, you know, City with a Kick in It, which is a great essay. It's always sort of been a source of puzzlement to Montanans around the rest of the state.
The final section of the book talks about films.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a film made a few years ago in which Sam Shepard was one of the characters or one of the actors, but it didn't do very well.
It didn't. I think I say in the book that, you know, they spent $11 million making it, and I think it only grossed $1 million at the box office. And I don't know if they've made that up now with DVD or streaming rentals, but I was surprised that it didn't do better.
There were a lot of empty streets in the scenes in the film, which maybe some people found unbelievable, but it looked true to me.
Right, and I quote from Roger Ebert's review of it. He loved the film, but he said, you know, maybe the reason that the critics don't like it is that so many things happen in this film that are unreal. And he describes a scene where a couple has a fight and she throws all the guy's stuff out the window onto the street, including a couch. And then for 3 or 4 days after that, the guy just sleeps on the couch in the street. And Ebert just says, it's unexplained, you know, it's kind of magical. And I thought when I read the review, you've never been to Butte, because that could happen.
It could totally happen.
Right.
What was the name of that one?
Don't Come Knocking, with Sam Shepard, Jessica Lange, but directed by Wim Wenders, who did Wings of Desire.
If you had to narrow this down to one or two novels to recommend to somebody and one film, what would you choose?
Wow, that's a tough one. I guess I would start by saying almost all the critics would agree that if there's only one book you're going to read about Butte, it should be Richard K. O'Malley's Mile High, Mile Deep. And I think that's probably a pretty safe place to start. That's a great book. My personal favorite that I discovered is Ed Leahy, who is a Butte poet. And as far as I know, it's the only novel he ever wrote, called The Thin Air Gang. That's about moonshiners in Butte during the Depression. As far as films go, Don't Come Knocking is pretty good, but to really get a sense of what Butte was like back in the day, there's a short 16-minute film called Romance of Butte, which is a, you know, it's a complete Hollywood story. It's only maybe 22 minutes long, and that was made in 1916 or 17, and that's pretty amazing. Silent movie.
I'm going to put a plug in for Psycho Sheep of Butte.
Which you just recommended to me, I hadn't heard of, but I can't wait to go see that one. I'm sure I missed a lot.
Aaron Parrott lives in Helena, Montana. You'll find more information about him and Literary Butte at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. It's also on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.